all, thank you to the Philadelphia Society for inviting me to speak to you today. I was somewhat perplexed when I was given this topic to address because I don't have any children, or at least not yet, no offspring to write to or to receive letters from. So I thought I would use this as an opportunity to speak about some of the challenges facing those who describe themselves as conservatives, and in my brief time to focus upon one issue that I think needs greater and more serious attention from conservatives. Of course, looking backward and forward in time is always a tentative exercise. People who described themselves as conservatives 40 years ago, would we assume have been worried by totalitarianism? They would have been perplexed by economic socialization and somewhat astonished by the eruption of that collective silliness that we now call the 1960s. Now, fortunately, much has changed. Communism has gone the way of the dinosaurs. Economic life seems somewhat freer. With the notable exception of the EU, the Keynesian sclerosis continues to crumble as economic liberty and free trade slowly expands around the world. The freewheeling, free love euphoria of the 60s seems dated, even a little pathetic, symbolized by an aging Hugh Hefner as he gyrates vainly against the coming of the night. So I think there are many reasons to be optimistic about the future of ordered liberty, both in America and also outside the United States. But there are problems. One obvious challenge is that of a radical Islamist movement, which is at war with the West. And then there are more subtle problems, such as what's happening in all our universities. These are weighty matters, and others could speak with more wisdom than I on such subjects. But I want to use my time today to consider an especially daunting question that it seems to me some conservatives are unaware of, others uninterested in, and many just plain uncomfortable about even discussing in polite company. The question is that of human biotechnology, and the more specific question of whether it will serve human dignity or whether it will be used to diminish that very same dignity. The challenge is, in brief, to our very nature, precisely as human beings. The abolition of man, I want to suggest, is no longer the elegant title of a much-read book. We are staring its possibility squarely in the face, and our reaction will determine, to a large extent, whether our grandchildren live in a distinctly human community or whether they will inhabit some version of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. Many of the technologies that Huxley envisaged in his prophetic work, such as surrogate motherhood, in vitro fertilization, and the use of psychedelic drugs, are here. In many respects, these practices emerged rather quietly, and this too was foreshadowed in Brave New World, where the evil is not so obvious because nobody is apparently hurt. Indeed, in Huxley's world, everyone gets what they want. People are seduced rather than compelled to live in an orderly but arid collectivity. People have no aspirations to anything in Huxley's world. They no longer have families. They no longer struggle to achieve goals, make hard moral decisions, or do any of the things that we associate with being distinctly human, such as love another person. Leon Cass puts the point this way. Unlike the man reduced by disease or slavery, the people dehumanized a la Brave New World are not miserable, don't know that they are dehumanized, and what is worse, would not care if they knew. Whether the human biotech revolution will serve man or serve as the tool for our self-destruction will depend very much upon the culture in which human biotech advances have predominantly occurred, that is, the West. And here we have reasons for concern. For the West is increasingly a culture in which suicide is considered rational and in some cases obligatory, where natural death is considered undignified, and where caring for people who are disabled, born prematurely, or drowning in despair is often viewed as a waste of resources. It's a culture in which some people celebrate Jack Kevorkian as a hero rather than knowing him for what he is. It's a culture in which so-called cutting-edge bioethics insists that there's nothing special about human beings, that there is no presumption in favour of life per se, and which increasingly holds, either implicitly or explicitly, that there are two classes of human beings, persons and non-persons. The non-persons including groups such as the pre-born, those infants who have not yet attained consciousness, not to mention the elderly. Many contemporary bioethicists believe there is no intrinsic reason why these non-persons cannot be medically abandoned, no intrinsic reason why they cannot be exploited as a natural resource, no intrinsic reason why they cannot be experimented upon, and in some circumstances, no intrinsic reason why they cannot be terminated. It's a culture in which most doctors today are no longer required or expected to swear the Hippocratic Oath. So let's ask ourselves some searching, perhaps uncomfortable questions. How far is this culture removed from the eugenic policies promoted under the Nazi regime? Policies legitimized in advance by those philosophers, doctors, lawyers, and scientists whose vision of a genetically cleansed world found a response in the German euthanasia programs in the late 1930s for the mentally and physically disabled. How far is this culture removed from the compulsory sterilization of the disabled, such as existed in the enlightened social democrat paradise of Sweden until the early 1970s, a practice given legal protection in 1927 by the United States Supreme Court because, as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes infamously put it in Buck v. Bell, three generations of imbeciles are enough. Given the gravity of what is at stake for ourselves and future generations, I find it surprising that relatively few people who describe themselves as conservatives seem to think that these issues matter. There are some exceptions to this rule, but not many. And I keep asking myself why. Why are so many conservatives apparently reluctant to engage such matters? If conservatives are serious when they invoke words like human dignity, if conservatives really believe that it is wrong to instrumentalize people, if conservatives reject the notion that there is life unworthy of life, then why are so few conservatives willing to confront the new profession of bioethicists, the vast majority of whom do believe and do teach that there is life unworthy of life? The banality of evil is alive and well today. It's flourishing quietly in medical and scientific laboratories, in philosophy and ethics classes, and it is not personified by the faceless, uniformed bureaucrats who engineered the final solution, but rather by the harmless-looking Princeton professor gently explaining to his students that only Luddites would oppose cloning, and that the life of a cow is in some instances worth more than a three-month-year-old baby. These are distasteful, unpleasant subjects. Every one of us knows the chill of unease, the air of slight embarrassment that prevails when they emerge into the light, and the irresistible impulse to turn the conversation elsewhere. Perhaps that's why some conservatives shy away from these issues, paying lip service to their importance, but preferring to engage their minds on other, more pleasant, more traditional, perhaps less controversial, perhaps less unsettling questions. The irony, of course, is that unless the human biotech revolution, which has so much promise, serves man as a human being rather than enslaves him, then the things that conservatives have traditionally celebrated about human life, joy, beauty, knowledge, friendship, conversation, choice, freedom, struggle, and achievement could become relics of the past, emblems of a life that existed before the advent of a post-human and therefore dehumanized world. Thank you.